evening, everyone. Welcome to Holy Crap, the Vlogcast. Vlogcast that comes from a skeptical point of view to answer some of the questions of why. This vlogcast started as a combination of spite and the Streisand effect when some people on Facebook that I knew back from high school decided that they wanted to complain about my using Facebook the way that I wanted to, which was to correct stuff that they were posting, which was factually wrong, which was the way that they wanted to do Facebook. Double standards much. Part of this is also to follow through with the old adage that sometimes the journey is more important than the destination. I am known as Shujin Tribble all over the place. I was born to a Roman Catholic family in Brooklyn, New York, raised on Long Island. I am currently residing outside of Buffalo, New York, and am an unabashed atheist. The roundtable is a little bit different tonight. I'll tell you about that in a couple of moments. Starting, however, over into the north side, well, actually, yeah, it is kind of north and west of where I am currently from Buffalo, across the border into Ontario. Good morning, Heretic Woman.
Good morning. So I am in Ontario, Canada, and I started out in the United Church of Canada, which is pretty darn liberal, all things considered. But then I made a silly decision and joined a Calvinist sect, which I really don't recommend because they're kind of crazy. But I figured it out 26 years ago that it's all crap, and I've been an atheist for all that time, and now I am being as mouthy and everywhere as I possibly can.
Moving to the south of me, into Pittsburgh. Good morning, Joey.
Oh, so good about it. Howdy, folks. Go ahead, say what you want.
Go on.
All right. Howdy, folks. My name is Joe. I was born to an Irish Catholic family in Chicago, Illinois. I spent 8 years in the United States Army, and I am now living in Pittsburgh as a graphic designer and an atheist.
And then moving across the ocean over into Paris this morning. Good morning, Joseph.
Good morning. My name is Joseph Schomburg. I am an atheist since about 20 years now. And I do everything I can to promote independent thought and critical thinking eventually.
So good morning, everybody. Yes, the roundtable is a little bit different tonight. Dallin is currently traveling. He is down Pittsburgh way. So he's over there with you, Joe. You're having a good time with him?
Ain't seen him yet because, you know, they're staying downtown and I'm not quite downtown.
Okay, so that would be yes. You're having about as good a time as any. Chris is not quite awake and with us, it would apparently seem, but that's okay. There's a spot waiting for him. Bridget is not feeling really well, so she's taking the night off. And Unreno Tech has got stuff to do early in the morning, so he's waving off as well, which is perfectly fine. We really didn't want to see his pussy on camera again anyway. Those of you that are long-time viewers of the show know exactly what I'm talking about, and you're welcome.
I face-palmed so hard on that one, I broke my glasses.
Brilliant. I could call one of mine over if you wanted.
That's okay. I'm feeling rather neglected as it is, considering. But we'll come back to that. We'll come back to that in a couple of moments. However, just getting started for the night with apologies to Noah Heath Lucinda from The Skating Atheist with 5 minutes on your clock for your 5 minute freestyle. I had another one of those moments where it was like, okay, I've got nothing better to do except to drive the delivery van from one place to another on Friday, and all of a sudden, just there was, as usual, which I love that. I love it when I have moments like that. The teaser that I gave for everybody was that I've got a slick answer for you to consider. Now, we have been fortunate enough, I guess you could say, to have been graced with the presence of Nephilim Free on one of the previous videos, which is kind of cool, kind of creepy. And he is one of those apologetics guys who's really just needs to get the hell out more often, but be that as it may. For those of you that are unaware of Matt Slick, and first off, if you're not familiar with him, congratulations, because you soon will be. Matt Slick is one of those apologetic type guys who claims, and I will go ahead and I'll go with him on this one, that he has studied the Bible, he has studied the ancient languages, He's studied the original manuscripts. Red flag here, people.
He has. Well, the originals. He could have seen them.
But he's got all this knowledge. He will talk up, down, left, right. He has gone head-to-head against Catholic apologetic people and claimed that they don't know what the hell they're talking about, and it's kind of fun to hear them spinning their wheels. But Matt Slick's big question is the following. If I'm saying it correctly, and I believe that I've got it correct, it is the following. Quote, what proof and evidence do you have that atheism is accurate and correct?
What?
Now, he has been on various different programs, various different shows, various different skeptics, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He has called into the Atheist Experience of Austin on several occasions under assumed names, under false pretenses, and has done that to various different shows. And all the time when people try to explain that question doesn't even make sense, it's a malformed question, it's taking stuff into assumption that is not, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, he will just harangue up, down, left, and right and claim victory all the time that he's shitting all over the game board and kicking over all of the chess pieces. And some people understand the meme that I'm referring to with that. So, Freddy, I had a thought as far as to, if we take this on face value, it's a bad question. But as usual, we like to go with why. Why is the question even being asked? So the question then becomes, if you try to interpret pidgin English, which is the closest thing that I can come with this, the question is, why is atheism, in your opinion, the right way to go? Now, if we take it under that, it's not what's being asked, but it's the spirit of the thing, as they say. So there's only one answer. I don't have any. The answer is there is none. There is no proof and evidence, or proof or evidence. There's no evidence and proof, no matter how you want to slice it, because it actually should be one to the other, that atheism is accurate and correct.
But...
and there's a reason why. Because there doesn't need to be. See, that's the problem with this question. It takes an assumption, and it's putting it into the wrong light right from the get-go. So, Matt, if you do happen to ever take a listen to this, for whatever stupid reason, what proof and evidence do I have that atheism is accurate and correct? You know what? I don't. And that's exactly as it should be. Because if I had any proof, if I had any evidence, guess what? I wouldn't need to be an atheist. Welcome to episode 71 of Holy Crap. You're a tool. And I've been told that on several occasions. Usually it's a little bit more, well, less subtle, but as it may. A couple of pieces to get things started over here, of course. First off, we have to acknowledge, of course, for Heretic Woman and Joseph, happy Canada Day this past week.
Thank you.
Did you guys celebrate anything at all over in France, by the way?
No, for Canada Day?
Yeah, I mean, any kind of observance for yourself?
No, just work as usual.
Pity.
Unfortunately. But the big day here is in a few days. It's the 14th of July.
Mm-hmm. Bastille Day.
Bastille.
Mm-hmm. And Heretic Woman, you had a new flag, do you?
I have two, actually. That's the small version. That's the large version.
That's the in-your-face version.
Yes. Yeah. This was the I can stick it in my bun version. There we go.
The big version is for deaf people.
And of course, for just yesterday, for myself and Joey, happy Independence Day, man. And thank you for making it something with little pieces that you do.
And all I have is a rocket pop. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
I don't do fireworks.
A few mortars?
Well, having had experience with explosives on the receiving end, I'm not a fan of booms, shall we say. And here's the problem that I ran into, and not to harp too much on it, but my local township, one of the suburbs of Pittsburgh, runs their fireworks show out of the local high school, or middle school, actually. The middle school football field, which just happens to be a few hundred yards from my window.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. When my entire apartment is shaking and there are, you know, loud explosions outside, yeah, I wasn't necessarily having a great time. But que sera, sera.
Whatever will be, will be.
So, we went to see fireworks here locally, which were nice. Yep. I enjoy them, but, you know, over lake.
Yeah, little one and I went with some friends of the family. We went up to the 8th floor, the top roof of the parking garage downtown Buffalo, where I parked my car anyway from work, and right. We got to see the canal side. And that was pretty damn cool. Plus, being able to see a nearly 360-degree view of the surrounding region, and everywhere was lit up. It was amazing. Nice. I feel so bad for the various police officers kind of looking around and going, where do you want to start?
Well, if anybody wants to see the fireworks that I saw, I posted it on my Facebook and my YouTube channel, so you can watch the whole thing just as I did.
Yep, I got a picture up on Facebook and Twitter, and I put I've got a 1-minute video that I still have to upload, but to get around to that. To all of the on our side, however, for all of the military, veterans and current service, thank you very much for your time, your support, and of course for your defense. And for those of you that are doing it just because it's a buck, at least do the job right, would you please? We'd appreciate it. So as usual, let's take care of a couple of pieces of housekeeping. Heretic Woman, as usual, gotta know, Raif Badawi is currently where?
In jail in Saudi Barbaric Arabia.
Which means as of the recording of this episode, it is now 3 years, 18 days. We are still waiting for you. We're still hoping for you. We really want you to come home soon. And as usual, and actually I'm changing this up just a little bit, I'd like to say hello to the 5 countries that would be watching us right now. That would be Austria, hallo, Egypt, salam, Bahrain, salam, Argentina, hola, and Philippines. I could not find a translation for Filipino, I'm sorry, so just hello, because English. Anyway.
Nobody watching from France.
Well, I haven't gotten to France. I've still got a number of countries. I'm only doing them 5 at a time. And when I had first checked, it was 95 countries. So,
time.
Yeah, I was very, very surprised when that had happened. I forget what episode it was when I finally checked it, but it was a real wake up call. I think it was episode 52.
Actually,
no, it was 2 months in, so it was 60-ish. 58, something like that.
Depending on which dialect is used.
Hmm.
Sorry about that.
Somebody backing up.
No, that would be my microwave. I'm getting some munchies ready. Anyway, if the dialect they happen to use is, if I'm using this correctly, Pegbody, then all you would have to say is hi. Because it's the same.
Okay, then.
That's convenient.
Yep. And some longtime viewers will recognize that I have a different setup for my microphone. Yes, my boom finally came in. I've got it bolted overhead, which it's probably really not what it's designed for. But you know what? Screw it. I don't care. It works. Now I just need one of those big network squares to put on my microphones with a logo and everything. We'll see about that later. So, as always, those of you that are watching live, of course, I've got two of you showing currently. If you'd like to take advantage of the question and answer system, please, by all means, feel free to do so. And, of course, as always, if you'd like to go ahead and send a message over to us where we're live, you can send a tweet over to myself at Shujin Tribble or to the group at Holy Crap TV. And, of course, if you'd like to send an email, you can send it over to... which email address is it? Podcast. There we go. Podcast at holycrapthevlogcast.com. The website is up and running again. We need to find out what it was that's spewing out a whole bunch of code and killing my bandwidth, but we'll see what happens. And Chris is just letting us know he'll be with us momentarily. So we're going to start off with the easy one for this episode. And yes, I know it's a lightweight topic, but... there are pieces of it that are actually pretty significant as far as I think of it. For instance, I want to start off with the gentleman by the name of Robert Oppenheimer. Anybody remember him? By name, maybe, probably not.
The name sounds familiar, but I can't place it.
All right. How about... oh, shoot, I'm drawing a blank. Goddard, I believe, was his name.
Jean-Luc Godard? Which one?
Well done, because for some reason I'm drawing a complete blank on his proper name. Well, crap. Here's why. I'm thinking of who is considered the grandfather or the father of modern rocketry. And I'm probably screwing up because I'm a little on the tired side. So I'm doing good, really, really good. Never mind. Anyway,
I believe what you're looking for is Robert H. Goddard.
Okay, good. Thank you. Probably is, because now all I've got in my mind is Beekman from Beekman's World talking with the dead guy. And Chris has got it over there, too, Robert Goddard. Thank you. Yes. Thank you.
Robert H. Goddard built the world's first liquid-fueled rocket, launched it on March 19th of 1926.
Now, the rocket engines, the rocket as we know it, had one of its first uses as warfare. And those who grew up into the World War II era, especially over into England, know all too well the buzz bomb. Now, Joey, you, of course, you know a lot more about it than we do because you've had some experience with warfare, let's be perfectly frank. And Chris is joining us. I'll have him chime in on this in just a second.
The buzz bomb was jet propulsion more than rocketry. V1 was rocket.
Yeah, V1 was rocket. V2 had the jet nacelle on the back end, and it would cut off just before it began its descent. And that's where that telltale whistle would come from.
Okay, so apparently I'm doing great tonight with this topic. This is good.
It's fine. Fun fact.
Just the word buzz bomb. That's all. Easily.
Fun fact, the common term used for them at the time among the British, one of the common terms at least, was robots. They were referred to as robots.
How's that?
Because they were unmanned.
Okay.
Well, get and to... they were in a way because they had a rudimentary navigational system.
Yeah, they had some both remote and automatic guidance systems on them. Not necessarily what we have today, but I mean, hell, we as Americans were developing guided missiles using pigeons.
Yes,
we would house a pigeon in the nose with a small, almost camera lens, or set up in the nose, so that it would picture the silhouette of a boat. And we taught the pigeons to peck at the boat, and it would help. The pigeons would guide it so that the boat was at the center of what it was of the targeting. And with each peck, it caused the control system to adjust to point the rocket that way.
Wow.
We also designed bats to become flying bombs, flying fire bombs. So.
Yes, but that we don't talk about animal cruelty. But actually, I think we'll talk with Lotka about that.
To be fair, the bats that they were trying to develop that way got out and set the base on fire that they were being developed at.
Yes, they did, didn't they? So let's pull it on over. By the way, good morning, Chris. Good to see you again. I hope you're doing well.
Fine, thank you.
So really quickly, go ahead and introduce yourself for everybody, and we'll get you going here.
Oh, hi, this is Chris from England. The background was raised nominally Catholic, but it never really stuck. And I've been an atheist for many years, and over the last few years, I've started being more public and vocal about it after seeing a lot of people get hurt by a lot of... say falsehood and religious belief.
And by the way, just because I saw this during my Facebook feed earlier today, I thought it was very appropriate. Happy Treason Day to all of us over here. So, thought you'd get a good kick out of that one.
Awesome.
So, since you live in the country where the World War II, where the buzz bombs were an incredible terror, I had friends of the family that lived in London and outside, some friends of the family lived in Northampton. I guess you could say I was fortunate enough to hear what some people thought of it who were alive at the time, but most of them were not. And they at least were taught, you see this building over here? You see this piece that's chunked out of that? That was the Germans that did that. From where you are now and where you've grown up, did you, your family, ever have to deal with that during World War II? Or were you guys fortunate enough to be far enough out of the blast zone, so to speak?
Let's see. I had... a couple of people of that generation were off overseas serving at the time, and I think most of the rest of the family were based fairly much out in the sticks, so away from the major cities. But it's something that was never really sort of gone into in family conversations, so as far as I can remember.
All right, that works out. Now,
Well, it should be worth noting. One, we got a little mixed up. The V2 was the rocket. The V1 was the one with the jet engine.
Okay. Well, that still works out. I can work with them both.
And the other one was that, since we're on the subject of tools of warfare being used for something else, something that should be brought up is that radio and television were used as guidance systems in those rockets. And those were two of the first uses of them at the time. Now look, there's a television and a radio. There's a television in almost everybody's house. There's a radio in everybody's car.
A lot of our technology comes from military research.
Yeah, which is to be understandable when you consider the amount of investment capital that has to happen in the first place. The thing that I wanted to tease out of this was that the buzz bombs did use two different propulsive technologies, one of which was, as was mentioned, jets. And as we know, well, some of us know full well, the very first jet aircraft, or some of the first production jet aircraft, was the, oh shoot, I forget which one it was. Do you remember, Joe, what the Germans had?
An Messerschmitt aircraft. The Messerschmitt.
It was
the ME-1 or the ME
261.
261, sorry.
Okay. The 26 series. The Messerschmitt series. It was a flying wing, which was unheard of at the time, and it was a jet engine.
Yeah, and as far as speed was concerned, it blew everything else out of the air. I mean, it was absolutely hellaciously fast, and nobody could touch it.
Speed-wise, yeah, but for dogfighting, it wasn't much, because it was so fast compared to the other aircraft.
No, it was designed as a bomber interceptor, because it was one of the few aircraft that could get up to altitude with the bombers, actually get over top of them, and then start coming down over top of them across to strafe them. And that was the idea, was that when you saw the bombers coming in, you'd launch this thing, and it was so fast that it could actually intercept the bombers as they're coming on their bomb run. Before that, once a bomber was on a bomb run, that's it.
Yeah, all you could do is just sit back and hope. Now, the jet aircraft, as we know full well, the jet propulsion technology has evolved remarkably to the point where it was not at all unusual for me, growing up on Long Island, to getting ready to go to college all the way across the state, what would have been otherwise an 8-hour drive, to pay $100, go to the airfield on Long Island where I was living, which was not too far away from where Lucky Lindy took off. Some of you need to look up Lucky Lindy. And for $100, take a jet aircraft to Buffalo. You know, an hour, hour and a half in the air, if that, and then, you know, a taxi out to the college. And it would take almost as long on the road to get from the airport to the college as it did in the air to get from home to Buffalo. So now it's just used, and nobody thinks twice about it. And yeah, it's still used in aircraft for warfare, because, I mean, what the hell else you got? Oh, wait, that's right. You've got rockets. So now, what are we doing with rockets? Well, we've still got... Here's a new term for everybody. ICBMs. Yeah, and you went ahead and you said something. I was going to hit you anyway. You know full well what that term is.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Heretic Woman.
Oh, go ahead.
I believe, isn't that intercontinental ballistic missile?
Yes.
Yes, that's right.
Yep, that's it. And for those of you that are too young to remember hearing that term, first off, in all seriousness, congratulations. Growing up in the, you know, I was born in 1969. There were still, when I was growing up in the 70s, there were still civil defense drills where you were supposed to get under your desk for, you know, a potential air raid, go into the hallway and cover your head. Plus, you know, fire drills where you're supposed to go out the door and to your assigned locations, just in case. These days, we don't worry about that, or minimally, we don't necessarily need to nearly as much as we used to, although some would say otherwise. But ICBM, intercontinental ballistic missiles, the idea is to launch a huge nuclear payload, actually lots of nuclear payloads, and lob them over the North Pole and then drop them on somebody else.
Yep. And that's when Star Wars became something besides a movie.
Yep, and that's
to be fair, it was only ever a movie, but
okay, but it became an idea beyond a movie then.
Right, Star Wars was the code name for the I forgot what the actual name, the technical name for it was.
I don't think I ever knew, or if I did, I don't remember either. But it was Reagan's pet thing.
Yeah. President Ronald Reagan of the United States had this grand idea that we would have platforms up in space that would have either anti-missile missiles or anti-missile lasers or something that would prevent...
Lasers.
Yeah.
The term that you were looking for was the Strategic Defense Initiative.
Okay.
One of those, right.
I can talk today.
No, that's perfectly fine. I get that. But the idea was it was supposed to have been to prevent intercontinental ballistic missiles from coming from the Soviet Union, saying that very specifically, the Soviet Union, from coming over the North Pole and impacting the continental United States. Although, you know, Canada, all right, fine, we'll take care of Canada too. Well, at the time,
stop them over Canada.
Yeah,
which
kind of meant it would just rain radiation on us, wouldn't it?
Funny you should mention that one, because as I'm fond of reminding everybody, and all right, get to that in a second. Yes, it would have done exactly that. Unfortunately. Fortunately, we never had to find out because, as we also know, fortunately, that entire thing was just a boondoggle that never went anywhere, fortunately. Now, as was mentioned, yes, it would rain nuclear waste all over on stuff. Now, I have joked on many an occasion before, heretic woman, and I know that you're going to have the biggest laugh out of this, and it's one of those painful laughs. You did take a nuke for us once. So
we did.
See. Russia. Now, I'm pretty sure it was Russia, not the Soviet Union at the time.
Yes.
If memory serves, it was Russia who launched a satellite, I believe it was in a polar orbit, that did not achieve orbit properly. It was actually too low. It burned up, and it fell to Earth, I know not where. Oh, right, in Canada. And its energy system was nuclear.
Okay.
It'd be, is it radioisotope thermal generator?
Yeah. Something like that, yeah. And
when did that happen?
That was, if memory serves, that would have been in the early 80s, I think.
Okay.
Then that would still be the Soviet Union.
Yes.
Yeah, quite right. Quite right.
That's why I don't remember, because at that point, if it wasn't cartoons, I wasn't interested.
Fair enough. But the
Cosmos. Cosmos 954 was the satellite.
Okay, and it had a nuclear payload for power generation, not solar. Not solar cells. And it fell, it cracked open, and splooged a whole bunch of radioactive waste all over the place. To best of my recollection, less than 1% of the nuclear material was ever recovered. So there is something about this that kind of links all together, because as we know full well, the big weaponry is nuclear weapons. Atomic, nuclear, fusion, whichever version it is that you're looking at, and it's just bad. However, the use of it for generation of power is a very, very, very good thing because it lasts a long ass time. Let me get you again, Chris, because you're late, so I'm gonna lead on you because you know bad coming to class late. There are a couple of really, really interesting pieces of artwork and scientific exploration that are whizzing their way out there into open space, into potentially out towards the Oort cloud right about now. Two of them in particular that I'm thinking of that are working off of nuclear-powered batteries.
The Voyager probes.
See? I knew you were on your ball there.
Something.
Voyager 1 and 2, winging their way out into the cosmos, the most distant man-made objects to date. And we are still getting telemetry from them 37 years? Wow. 37 years on. And the sun at this point is little more than a pinprick in the rest of the rest of the cosmos. I mean, there is not enough power. I forget how to describe it, but if memory serves, the radio signal that is the radio telemetry that is coming back from Voyager at this point, what little there is tantamount to trying to see or trying to hear, as the case may be, a nightlight from New York City as viewed from Los Angeles, I believe was the way that it was described. I could be wrong. I may be misremembering it, but it is an incredibly faint signal at this point simply because it's so the hell far out there. And, yeah. Well, let's face it, radio is not very much different from solar radiation. It spreads out, and the further away you get, it fades because it's got that inverse square law, I think it is, video as well.
Yeah, so if you get something twice as far away, it's the signals spread over the four times as much area. So it's... as you go farther away, signals diminish very rapidly. I just did a quick check. So the radioisotope thermal generators on these things are producing somewhere just over 300 watts of power, which is a tiny amount on there if you're looking at transmitting across the solar system. And running the rest of the spacecraft as well.
Your average hair dryer runs twice that.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, I mean, look at your light bulbs.
It's three light bulbs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Plus, I had a portable hair dryer when I went to college, and it was 1,500 watts. Mm. I mean, it's positive, massive.
Most of them are that now.
Yeah.
I recently bought a new one, and I was trying to find one that was actually more powerful than that, but that's all I could find.
Yeah, and we're talking about one of the most scientifically advanced devices that had been crafted up until that point. And one of its most impressive pieces of information of technology is a record. A honest-to-God gold-plated album with information about our planet, which is pretty damned cool. Now, since we were talking about radio, there are two pieces about this. Item number one, which was a very cool one, is Wi-Fi, which is an offshoot of radio, because it's using electromagnetic spectrum. Here's the thing. World War II. Joey was making reference to it before. America and Britain were using radio to guide torpedoes from submarines.
And more importantly, they were also using it to detect incoming missiles and aircraft.
Now, what had happened was the Germans found out about this, and they did what any smart group would do. They used radio against it to jam the signal so that stuff would go off into Never Never Land. Well, oh, crap, I forgot what her name is now. Joey, if you would look it up for me. Spread spectrum frequency hopping is the methodology that is currently used for Wi-Fi, so that you don't necessarily need to sit on a particular frequency, like your TV or your radio, but you can jump from one frequency to another, transmitting and receiving, over larger area of the spectrum, in order to figure out, in order to safely transmit and receive information.
Without interference.
Exactly right.
It helps if I unmute myself. Yeah. The name you're looking for is Hedy Lamarr.
Thank you. That's exactly who it was. Hedy Lamarr in the World War II era was one of the most gorgeous women. She was, I believe she was also a model. She was an actress. She starred in a number of movies. She made a number of appearances all over the place. And she was effing brilliant. She had designed the system, the forebearer to what we consider Wi-Fi now. And they had designed it so that you would have the radio transmitter for guidance and the radio receiver for guidance using frequency hopping, pre-selected frequencies and ranges, and they did it by using a player piano roll so that both sides were listening to the same frequency at the same time, transmitting and receiving were using the same time, and it was a mechanical system. And now we don't even think twice about it. It's just what we use because, you know, little tools, man, Wi-Fi, it's just there. The precursor was World War II's use. And, yeah, and there you go. Joey's got the picture of her right there. Hedy Lamarr. She was brilliant. Did not get the accolades that she deserved for her... she had a lot of scientific stuff. She was a brilliant woman.
And if I'm using the correct vernacular of the time...
Your French is not perfect, but I think it's acceptable enough to get the point across. You would agree, Joseph?
Yeah.
Good enough for me. And as far as radio is concerned, recording, Joseph, since you were so generous with your time, here you go. You know what this is.
I've got a whole box full of those things I brought from Canada.
For those that are listening from off the podcast version, go ahead, tell them what it is.
What, really? No, come on, we're not that old. A cassette.
Yes.
Well, but they can't see it.
Yeah, for the people that are just going to be listening to the audio.
It is an audio cassette tape.
Yes.
Right.
Which actually the first computer I ever used read its data from one of those too.
Oh, mine too, yeah. And we used to use those things to pirate music from the radio.
Oh, yes, yes. The song came on the radio, you had your tape in there and you just hit record and...
Your mixtape.
Yep, do your mixtape.
Yep, but of course we would never do that. That would be wrong. Okay,
oh,
so
yeah,
and that would have killed the music industry.
Of course,
absolutely, yeah.
You know,
it would have been dead by the end of the '80s, man.
They said that the gramophone would kill the live performance industry. So
yeah,
they've always had that argument.
Yeah.
So even though this was not exactly a wartime thing,
I found out recently that there was a semi-parallel development in audio recording called audio wire. Dig this.
Yes, I remember hearing about this.
Yep. They took a coiled wire. What's a good way of describing this? If you were to look at guitar strings, you would typically have a center wire with a secondary wire wrapped around it in a corkscrew fashion. What was done is they would actually energize with a magnet, an electromagnet, a magnetic field into each of those coils as it goes along through a read-write head that kind of looked like a V. Mm-hmm. And the bottom of the V is where the wire would be. And
it's an electromagnet.
Yes, exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently, it was using such an incredibly fast velocity that the fidelity was on par easily with audio cassette as what we use today, and it did not have the pop and hissle that you would typically have with an older audio cassette or with a vinyl album.
What did it record on?
On the wire itself, quite literally.
Yeah.
It's direct to sound?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's the medium that lowers the quality.
Yeah, you just magnetize parts of the wire essentially as it goes through to record, and then you just run it back through the magnet and read off the change in the electric field to play it back.
Yeah, and this was something...
It's just basically translating radio waves or electromagnetic waves into an electric signal, like a telephone.
Yeah,
actually,
I think it was used as part of the Frank Herbert's Dune science fiction story. It was that in our society they'd have all their data recorded on wires.
Now, the fun part about this is that until recently, I'd never heard of this. As a matter of fact, up until during this week. Mm. And then I found out that somebody was selling on eBay a wire recorder along with, believe it or not, several spools, one of which had the old Jack Benny show on it.
Uh-huh.
And they had a video showing it in action. As the first I'd ever heard of this. And
do you have a link to that?
I will have to relocate it and see about adding it for later. It was absolutely amazing to me. It's a technology I had never heard of before, and one that I'm still kind of trying to grasp my head around because it just feels wrong. So what do you laughing at?
Oh, well, since we've been on the subject of so many different World War II technologies. I came across something that I'd seen before, and it just makes me giggle every time I see it. Chris?
Yeah?
What has been included in every single armored vehicle of the British Army since World War II?
I'm just trying to remember the abbreviation for it. Is it BEU? Basically a kettle.
Yes.
Because
we've got to have your tea.
Exactly.
Armored vehicle crews were getting out of their vehicles, and using the fuel, like in a desert or whatever, to make a temporary stove in the sand. Cook their, boil their tea and whatever and have a smoke. And this is not particularly the safest place to do that. So they now have...
4 million euros for the Challenger tank. It makes tea.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
To the question, why don't Americans have tea kettles in our tanks? Because we brew our tea in the bay.
Yeah, but It is also used for heating rations and stuff, and can be used for treating water, etc. But yeah, it's quite an interesting thing that all the we have these, what was it, electric boiling units in all our armored vehicles, apparently.
At least I got to make Joe, Joe over there roll his eyes.
I love it. If I was going to be in the army, they'd have to have a tea kettle and whatever I was driving to.
Well, if we're going to go ahead and talk about tanks, we might as well talk about the guns that go along with them. I mean, the ability to aim a gun was also one of those things that, I mean, what other options do you have? Unless, of course, you watch the MythBusters and you think that, okay, firing a gun is for cutting down trees. Okay, that's cool.
Or firing chickens through windshields.
Firing chickens or bowling balls through houses.
Yes, I do recall that.
But we don't talk about that. What I'm getting at, though, is that there was a piece of technology that kind of came from that, which was the telescope. And it's hard to imagine now, but the telescope was used as a part of a weapon of war so that you could actually figure out, okay, what is where? How far out is it? All right, do the calculations. How far is it supposed to go? What angle are you supposed to shoot at? Okay, this should land on your enemy tanks over there. Well, not tanks at the time. You get the idea.
And yeah, I mean, telescopes and those kinds of massive pointing, aiming, and tracking systems had been around for a long time.
Oh, sure.
Various members of the aristocracy going back 200-300 years had massive telescopes, with like clockwork mechanisms for keeping them in sync with the Earth's rotation, so you could look at the same patch of sky on there for ages. And some of these things were huge, but yeah, it is mind-boggling that with the massive modern telescopes, how easy it is to how well they can track those. And it is a sort of a massive piece of very expensive scientific equipment that you're having to slew around quite quickly.
Yeah, for a couple $100, you can get a low to mid-grade telescope, and it's going to have GPS tracking. You tell it where you are or don't. It picks up where you are, point it at roughly north, set it at whatever the angle is that you're at latitude, and it calibrates itself for you. Are you on the right spot over here? I should be pointing at this star. Am I right on it? All right, good. I should be going over to this star. Is this it? Okay, adjust it just a little bit. Okay, right on it. Boom. All right, we're ready to go. What do you want to see next? And just let it figure out where everything is. It's amazing for that kind of thing. I have to get my telescope fixed still, as a matter of fact. But it's amazing to think that it's glass. It's a bunch of lenses, and it's part of warfare originally. I mean, who would even think of it anymore?
Yeah, I mean, the GPS part of that, yes.
Yeah, the telescopes themselves, and yeah, GPS was for, well, was for the armies, and I'm using the term broadly, I know. Now, when you were in the military, before President Clinton opened up the GPS accuracy for the civilian population, if I remember right, GPS signaling was supposed to be accurate to approximately 20 meters or so. Am I remembering that right?
About 15 meters.
Okay. Okay, and as it is now, it's down to within a meter, typically, yay?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Here's one that might boggle your mind. EpiPens.
Very good.
Auto-injecting syringes. originally they were designed to be given out to soldiers to protect them against nerve agents and chemical weapons.
Hmm.
Now, diabetics use them on a daily basis, and they save lives.
Yep, I got you there, Heretic Woman. For diabetes or for...
Yep.
There you go. And, I mean, we can expand this even a little bit further. 8-year-olds, 5-year-old kids can be carrying them around in case they go into anaphylactic shock because they got peanuts or they got stung by a bee. I mean, you can't get too much more ubiquitous than an 8-year-old is carrying around their own pen to save their own damn life just in case.
Mm-hmm.
And I can think of plenty just to keep going. The fact that we're actually on here doing this show right now, we can technically thank the military for.
Yep.
Computers.
Oh, yeah, the first web system was databases.
Not even talking about the internet. The very first computer, the first thing that you could... Well, okay, technically, we have found older examples dating back to the Greeks, but at the time, the computers as we know them began with the U.S. military during World War II. Yes, I know the Enigma machine, but where the Enigma machine had very specific settings that it had to abide by, whereas the American development was we're talking strictly electronic.
Yeah,
but
Chris, I know that you were raising your objection. You go ahead first.
I don't know that much about where the history and the funding came from, but the idea of a computer has been around longer than World War II, and mechanical and electromechanical calculating devices going back to, I think, the turn of the 20th century.
Automatons.
But what I'm actually specifically referring to is the first electronic computer that was capable of being programmed to serve many different functions rather than just calculating one thing or another.
Hmm. Yeah.
I mean, what can you do on your computer nowadays? Well, you can host a vlogcast.
Mm-hmm.
You can do a radio show. You can play video games. You can... bring up calculator, word spread, do your taxes.
It still requires a program, though.
Watch porn?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure we should be too proud of that one, but...
Yeah, why not? It beats, you know, stealing Mom's National Geographic.
But there is one military invention that the modern world simply could not exist without.
Oh, Jesus, here it comes now.
Toilet paper.
Close, but no. You're on the right track, though. Think spooling something around itself on a cardboard tube.
Paper towels?
Thread?
Not quite. Getting closer, though. It has thread in it.
Duct tape.
Ding, ding, ding! Give her a prize! It was originally intended to seal ammunition cases so that water couldn't get in.
Cool.
Now, you have duct tape of every variety everywhere you look.
Make prom dresses out of it.
And wallets.
Wow.
And in the case of Adam and Jamie, shoes and nets and...
bridges.
A boat.
And, you know, somehow I'm not entirely surprised that you, of all people, got a heretic whooping, what with Red Green being up there in Ontario somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah, I come from a long line of rednecks.
Those of you that don't know about Red Green, oh, God, what the hell is wrong with you? Look up Red Green. Seriously? He has more engineering prowess in his little finger than Tim Taylor did in his entire house.
Allure.
Pretty much. And seriously, red green is friggin' wonderful.
And when red greens, I guess for lack of a better word, inventions went wrong, they went wrong in a much more spectacular way than Tim Taylor's.
This is true. All right, I know I really shouldn't do this, but screw it, I'm going to do it anyway. One of the things that Red Green did was, for the winter, he built himself a Zamboni.
Yep.
He did it with duct tape, a whole lot of duct tape, some garden hoses, and he built it out of a K-car.
Yep.
Why a K-car, you might ask? His answer was, because with a K-car, it's really easy to get the fluids, the hot fluids, to come out of it. It's a lot harder to keep them on the inside anyway, so why not work with what you got?
I concur, because I used to drive a K-car.
Those of you that are too young to know what a K-car is, again, congratulations on being young and not knowing about this stuff. Well done.
Yeah. I've got more examples.
Okay, I'll give you one more.
If you like. Maybe. Oh, only one more? Only one more? Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, which ones are going to be? There's so many good ones.
Well, we got a good pick. No, actually, I'm going to wait. I'm going to make you wait, because Katie had a good two of them over here. And one of them I know is sort of military. Quick release buckles. Okay. I get that. I'm not specifically familiar with, but Velcro. Trademark. Which is one of the first times that the public would have seen it would have been in the military on a television series known as Star Trek.
Yep.
Go ahead, explain it, huh?
Well, that's how they kept their phasers on their belts. Of course, and that was next to the decorative Klingon bubble wrap.
Oh, God, you're killing me.
That was my favorite.
That's great.
I just never understood why we turned to using Velcro. And thankfully, they have corrected this and gone back to the old buttons. But for a long time, at least while I was in, we were using the new ACUs with the Velcro on the pockets. If you're a soldier...
What's an ACU?
The digital camouflage that the American Army, specifically the Army, uses, the one that is that kind of pea soup green color that really doesn't blend into anything except for maybe your grandmother's old floral couch.
Okay, yes.
Yeah. We had Velcro on the pockets, and now I can understand having the Velcro for like the name tapes and stuff, so that when you needed to change out your uniform, you can go ahead and peel those off, put them back on. Exactly.
Yeah.
For those that couldn't see, by the way,
I've got, I showed this off a couple of weeks ago, my brother's old flight patch from the Flying Tigers group. On the back side of it, it is the stuff.
Yes. I just never understood why we started using them on the pocket so much. One, it always wore out to the point where it would no longer close the pocket. And two, if you're a soldier and you're camouflaged and you're trying to remain stealthy, and you have to go into your pocket and, you know, there's an enemy maybe, you know, a couple feet away that, you know, in the dead of night you can't really see them.
Yeah.
Never made sense to me. So thankfully we have gone back to using the buttons for the pockets at least.
Or magnetic fasteners.
Yeah, but problem with those is now with all the electronics that we use these days could interfere with some things. But the one, since she did Velcro, I considered doing nylon, but she did Velcro, which is, you know, the same ballpark. Here's one, and there's no denying that this one is pretty damn important. Why do you use penicillin?
Ooh.
penicillin had been discovered before World War I, but it wasn't until World War I that it began to be used widely as a antibiotic. And it was applied to soldiers. It was used to treat trench foot. It was used for all sorts of infections and such. And now it's one of the most it is the most common antibiotic we use medically.
Mm-hmm. And it's done amazing things. I mean, the number of people it has helped, the number of lives that it has saved is positively incalculable at this point. It's one of those amazing things.
It's saved more lives than bullets have taken. I'm willing to wager on that.
Oh, I'm not a bitten man either, and I'm so with you on that one, absolutely. So since we've got that, let's kind of work through a couple of other things. Most especially, I don't know who wants to. Joey, I'm gonna have you sit this one out for a second because we've got a lot of stuff. You've got a lot of history on this one, so let's not be totally unfair on this one. So let's see who on the other side wants to go ahead and take on China and their big contribution to the entertainment that's happening. Well, all right, maybe not so much. Yeah, thank you very much.
History nerd.
Well, that and the Star Trek connection, of course, too, but that's a whole other issue for later.
I was going to bring that up with the whole rocket thing, but go ahead.
Well, they rockets that are set up with gunpowder typically kind of... Jebediah Kerman comes to mind. Yeah, you kind of get that. All right, so Heretic Woman, real quickly, because some people are going to be going, why is there another Star Trek connection here? What?
I'm not sure what you're referring to on that one with the fireworks.
The arena.
Oh, yes, that's right. With the Gorn.
Oh God, how freaking great is this that we can actually go ahead and make a reference? All you need is two words, and suddenly everything from the 1967 series comes up.
Yeah, it's like boof the Gorn, and Kirk having to make an impromptu rocket launcher out of just stuff laying around like sulfur in the dirt and all of that, and he just happened to have a tube laying around, you know, and yeah,
it's like a piece of bamboo or something.
Yeah, on this like completely alien planet that has nothing that Earth has except for all the stuff that he needs to make a rocket launcher.
Potassium nitrate, a bit of sulfur, and
and a stone, or like a big rock or something.
Charcoal.
They did, I believe, say that the aliens that beamed them down there said that they'd placed stuff there for them to find.
That's right, yes, but it wasn't like obvious. So he had to sit there, and the idea being that the Gorn was like this, you know, bipedal lizard creature, that it wasn't as smart as the humans. So, because humans had science, except the Gorn had space travel, so they couldn't have been that stupid. But you know,
So some of the first uses for gunpowder, as we know it today, goes back to China, at least as far as we've documented or is commonly accepted. Wow.
Accept.
Joey, I don't know what the hell it is that you did, but whatever it is that you did with your like speech impediment tonight, you can have it back, okay?
X to accept means to exclude something. To accept means to include something.
I got that. It's just coming out of my face hole. It doesn't want to work. Right.
Just think of the Mongols, and you'll be fine.
Thanks. Thank you so much.
And if I remember correctly, they discovered gunpowder through researching technology to make a hotter fire for iron making.
Not quite.
No.
You're not going to just go ahead and say...
Well, you told me to shut up on this one!
Well, no, you haven't shut up. Carry on.
Yeah.
It was originally... It was discovered by accident because there was a... there was a guy who was trying to practice a little alchemy, because one of the big things that Chinese emperors were after was, you know, the secret to immortality. They wanted to have, and, you know, that's why some went crazy, because they drank things like mercury. Yes. And this was one of the recipes that a guy had been working on, trying to find the secret to immortality, and it quite literally blew up in his face when he was going at it with a mortar and pestle.
Kaboom.
So, kind of the opposite effect of what he was going for.
Yeah.
But now we use it for much more mundane things, like launching things at high velocity that explode. Oh,
go
wait, we're
pretty
kinda,
counters.
Yeah, we're kind of going right on back to Joey's wheelhouse on that one right there, aren't we? Oops. Come on. And Katie also chiming in back again about the quick release buckles. She's kind of redescribing it. And it, as I'm reading it and kind of understanding it, well, let me read it off as how it's got over here. Quote, quick release buckles are the plastic buckles that you press on each side to release. Used a lot on things now. Dog collars are one place you see them a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that these are the ones that are overall rectangular in shape.
Yes. Think of the old Cold War era vests and belts that we had for the military. The ones with the buckles that went across the chest and...
Gotcha.
Those.
Let me bring
it
up.
Yeah, that's it.
Yep, you got it there. So those of you that are listening on the podcast version, you have no idea what we're talking about here. Here's a big opportunity for you. Come on over to YouTube, episode 71. You can look at it right from here. We are in the hour and 15-minute point. Figure it from there. Don't worry, you'll be close enough.
So, not exactly a military invention, but what I have here, which for those of you who are listening later, is a gel pen, which was created for astronauts to write with in space.
Because, you know, grease pencils were just so passe.
Yeah.
Apparently. But I love me some gel pens.
Yeah, forget that whole Russian pencil thing. We're going to go ahead and dump that $4 billion into researching a pen that'll write in space.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is... I love that joke, because it's a great example of how stuff isn't quite as simple as it first appears.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone automatically assumes that the Americans were lunatics for spending all this money developing these special pens that work in zero gravity when you've got perfectly good pencils around. The thing about pencils is that when you write with them, you get loads of dust off them. You have to sharpen them, and you've got wood shavings.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've in a place where you've only got one source of air, and that's coming through your air filters and whatever, and you've got lots of electrical equipment around there, you don't want any extraneous dust getting into clogging up air filters, getting into electrical circuits. We've since discovered that graphene is very electrically conductive.
Yep. Also, why we don't
want graphene dust floating around.
Exactly. Also, why we don't allow corned beef sandwiches on flights anymore.
Really?
There's a
story for later.
Okay. There's a story about that. We'll come back to that guy later. The uses of gunpowder are many and versatile, as we've come to understand. And the whole reason of wanting to go through this is that even though the title is "You're a Tool," which is typically a put down, there are so many times when what we've got to work with is a tool. It does work for us that we otherwise can't do for ourselves. And it's I know what I want to use, and I can't say it properly, so screw it. I'll move on from there. What it is as a tool is determined by what you do with it. Is it a good witch or a bad witch? It depends on what you're doing with it. Gunpowder is one of those things that is a perfect example. It was being used, or it was being researched for longevity. And eventually it became part of, well, small-scale rockets, as we've come to find out afterwards. There are ways of doing that. And it was used for its propulsive force, because it's explosive. Duh. So you got rockets out of it. You've got launching projectiles. Guns, for instance, almost exactly the proper purpose. Wow. I need to drink coffee earlier, yeah.
Or maybe one of these.
Other stuff like flash powder for early cameras and early in civil engineering or mining as an explosive before they moved on to better things.
There's a phrase that we probably should have used early on in this show that I'm surprised that we haven't used yet.
Which is?
Turning the sword into the plowshare.
That was what I was thinking of, and as a matter of fact, the flash paper and the photography thing was a piece that I was going to be coming over to, as a matter of fact, because in France, Joseph, not leading you off the hook, was it not the I'm trying to remember if it was the brothers or if it was just a single.
Lumiere, bro.
I'm sorry?
Lumiere?
Exactly. Exactly right.
But there was something before that. I can't remember his name. But go on. Finish your...
But the idea of photography and light writing, I guess, is one of the best ways of describing it for the technology of the day. There were a number of ways of doing it prior to having cameras as we would think of them today, film cameras, I should say. There were ways of, yes. There were ways of exposing photo... trying to remember what the right terminology for it was. Photoreceptive materials.
Close enough.
Yeah. Without a camera as we would think of it today. So you could actually put a piece of photoreceptive material out in literally broad daylight with stuff on top of it, like rocks and such, and you'd be able to get something that kind of qualifies as a photo. Very, very, very rudimentary by comparison. But when photo plates became possible, it was something akin to gunpowder, very close to it, that was utilized to generate a brilliant, brilliant flash. Oh, wow, that sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? In order to generate a very bright flash of light that would be exposed onto these otherwise difficult to expose plates. Sometimes they were metal, sometimes they were glass, depending as to what was being used. Now, it was... how is his name pronounced again?
Lumiere.
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 Which actually, in French, actually means light.
Yeah, yes. I was going to say the light guy.
Yeah, and that's what kills me. I did not take French. I took Spanish as my secondary language. So
I took Latin.
You highfalutin educated type, you.
As because of, yeah. because of religious. But anyways.
Yeah, don't worry. I have every intention of getting back in bashing religion again in the very, very near future. I just needed a softball.
I'm just checking with the flash powder. It's mainly either some kind of mixture of sort of powdered aluminium or magnesium with some form of oxidizer.
Yeah, the aluminium was there just to manage the color of the light.
And magnesium is something that we've seen on many an occasion. If you
Look out your window tonight, folks.
Sure enough. Or if you've ever dealt with sparklers, which you just have to be very careful with if you use them indoors, because they can burn your tabletop. Not that I would know anything about that.
Yeah. The white in fireworks, when you see a white explosion go off, that's magnesium. If I remember correctly, blue and green are some ratio of copper. Trying to remember the other ones.
I was going to say, red?
It's these... what gives... Well, I'll go ahead and look that up for you.
Yeah.
And that's how astronomers tell what's on other planets they can see. It's by the spectrum.
Exactly right. So the piece about this is that what you mix into, you get different colors. And whenever you come up with that one. And as an aside, by the way, for those of you that might be lucky enough to be watching in the future or listening in the future, if you get the chance to watch a fireworks display and you remember about it, if you see a brilliant, pure color, whether it's white or red or green or blue or purple, that is incredibly difficult to achieve.
Yeah.
Because you need to be very careful about exactly what you put in. And if you can get that bright, brilliant, pure color, no matter what it is, the display that it is showing up in the sky, if you can see that color, that is amazingly, amazingly difficult to achieve properly time and time and time again. That is an artistry. Yes, Joey?
Alchemy.
I was going to say, some of the colors, as I said, blues are for coppers. Green specifically is from barium. Yellow is from sulfur. And strontium is used to make red. And a combination of strontium and copper, very, very careful combination, can give you purple. But it's very, again, it's a very precise ratio that you need to achieve.
Yeah, there is a certain artistry, never mind chemistry, that goes into that. And by the way, one of the things that I had seen tonight I had never seen before for fireworks displays, there were a couple of them that went off where it started off as one color in this blossom, and as a single unit, all of these different pieces in this giant blossom changed from one color to another color to another color to another color before it faded out. Ooh. That was one I had never seen that before, and that was freaking awesome. So whoever it was this year that did the fireworks display at the canal side in Buffalo, holy Jesus, guys, well done.
See, we had some that would change from one to a second color, but just the two.
Yeah, it's the layering in the in the projectile after it's fired from whatever cache that they're using to house the fireworks before they're actually launched. Inside, you've got the little projectiles, and they burn according to the layer. So when you see them changing in mid-burst like that, that's because they have these multiple layers that are burning through.
And we had some that they would split into even smaller ones and kind of spiral away.
Yeah, please no Shrek references.
Shrek.
Layers.
Oh, yeah, I wasn't even thinking about it. Of course, now I am.
Now there was a piece about this that I was remembering it. I don't remember if this was actually happened or not. But I remember from watching MASH way back when, that there was somebody who had come through the hospital who was giving everybody a primer on dealing with new bullets that the North Koreans were utilizing.
I remember that episode.
Which had magnesium in them. And the problem is that magnesium, once it begins to burn, it won't stop until it's Well, so long as there is something to oxidize it against, it will keep burning.
Napalm.
Well,
no, not quite. But the closer one that you... Magnesium we typically use in things like tracers and such, which is where you see the bright line of light following a bullet. It's how machine gunners... I'm speaking from experience. I was a machine gunner. It's how we keep track of where our shots are going. Because you can use your sights, but, you're spitting out so many rounds, and the weapon is bouncing around so much, it's kind of hard to keep track now and then. So the tracers help with that. And the weapon that is most infamous for that sort of thing is the phosphorus grenade.
It might have been phosphorus, come to think of it, now that
because there are many, many horror stories, specifically from the Vietnam era, of soldiers who had been hit with a phosphorus grenade, and I have actually met an individual who survived such an occasion. It's not pretty. Water will not put it out. Mm-hmm. This man dove into the river, and it kept burning through. It will burn through flesh. It will burn through bone. It does not matter.
And yet, we do have these situations where it's horrible. I mean, it's a weapon of war. It's a tool that's being used for an incredibly nasty purpose. But at the same time, we've got opportunities for using simpler products in a different manner in order to do something worthwhile. Perfect example was TNT, dynamite. And as we know full well, TNT is one of the measures that fireworks today are measured against. Traditionally, you'd hear people talk about M80s as being like equivalent to a quarter stick of dynamite or a cherry bomb or something like that.
Yeah, we still use it as a rating system for pretty much any explosive, including nuclear.
And what was it utilized for? For one of its biggest uses? For the railroads? For going through rock? Mountains, hills that you didn't want to go ahead and go up over because, well, shit, why go over it when you can go through it? And that has its own history of bad. I mean, we have no idea how many Chinese, in particular, died out there in the West working on the transatlantic railroad system in the United States. That's not exactly a pretty situation to think about, but it was done. And today, there is a railroad that goes from sea to shining sea, as it's said over here, and the rail system, Chris, let me grab you a second. One of the most extensive rail systems was in Britain, in England. Mm-hmm. And the rail system is amazing for you guys.
Yeah, we don't normally think of it in that way. on there, because it's... but it is very extensive. I mean, just about every large city or town has got a rail link. But over here, it's famed for sort of irregularity of services, for lateness, for trains being cancelled by due to stupid excuses like too much snow or leaves on the line or something else. Most of this is probably fairly unfair, but
it's funny you should mention that.
What, the snow on the lines?
Yes. Because while we have discussed, technologies on a broad scale that have been used, I do actually have some specific examples of how weapons, in particular weapons, have been used for something other than war. For example, avalanches. Since World War II, the United States Army has provided the United States Forestry Service with artillery pieces and recoilless rifles to trigger avalanches so that they don't get to be a massive buildup that can otherwise cause damage. And this has been repeated throughout the world. They even took to calling them the avalanchers.
No, I kind of remember about that. Yeah, that they would use the functional equivalent of a howitzer cannon, no?
Yeah. And one example of something similar also has something to do with snow, but more importantly, it is probably the one most obvious example of beating a sword into a plowshare that I've ever seen, at least in modern times. There's a Ukrainian village, if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Ternopilia, who in 2002, the farmers of this village grouped together and they bought an old Soviet era, Cold War era tank. They stripped all the weapons off, they stripped the turret off, and they put a plow on it. And they turned it into a tractor that also doubles as a snow plow for the winter.
Nice.
That's a smart idea.
That is really amazingly cool. And, that is really amazingly cool.
You know, we've got examples of such similar things all throughout. I mean, this goes for both America and the Soviet Union. During the Cold War, what did we have a lot of?
Chutzpah.
Well, other than that, missiles.
Yeah,
right.
And a lot of places to house them. And nowadays, we're seeing more and more of these missile silos being converted into homes, hotels, yep, power generator plants. In fact, in particular, Russian nuclear weapons, and specifically nuclear weapons, warheads, have been used to provide as much as 10% of America's electricity in the 1990s, courtesy of the United States Enrichment Corporation, which disposed of 19,000 Russian warheads and converted the materials for power generation.
Yeah, now going back to those missiles again for a moment, we have seen how the technology from the Cold War for, you know, holding on to all of those payloads of nuclear death were reconverted and were reutilized and were turned into the space race. Now, admittedly, it's still kind of warfare or chest beating.
Pissing contest.
Mm-hmm. But what did humanity get out of it? The first steps off of the planet? That's pretty damn badass, you ask me. Now, admittedly, you know, the Soviet Union and Russia had stuff that kind of put us to shame here in the United States, and we don't really talk about it. The first man in space was a Russian cosmonaut. The first, well, almost first death in space might have been a Russian cosmonaut were it not for just, I need to get in.
Well, technically, it was still a Russian cosmonaut that died first in space, but...
Well, not exactly in space.
She counts. She may have four legs, but she was still a cosmonaut.
Yes.
True that.
Yeah. But some of the stuff that came out of the space race was absolutely amazing. And I want to specifically single out, even though it is U.S.-centric, I want to single out Apollo 13 because it is incredibly well documented as far as to what ended up happening. What was amazing, damn it, and now that I brought it up, I need to clarify it. Apollo 13 was the third, yes, it was going to be the third manned landing on the moon by NASA. And en route to the moon, one of the oxygen tanks exploded. And how they did not completely blow up the entire thing is anybody's guess. But fortunately enough, they had enough that they were able to make a free return trajectory change so that they would just fly around the moon, come home, and hopefully come home in one piece. And there were a lot of points in that after the explosion happened in that oxygen tank where their getting home was questionable, to put it nicely. But the imagination, and I'm not going to say the imagination of the American scientists or the engineers, just the imagination that was displayed was amazing. Stuff that shouldn't have worked together, they found a way to make it work. You needed an oxygen, a carbon dioxide scrubber, and you got pieces that don't fit together. We'll make it fit together. We'll find a way. They'll do it. And it was a quote:
"The square peg in the round hole."
Quite literally. And the link that was just put into our chat over here, by the way, was I didn't see who it was that put it there. Was that the Russian space orbiter?
Yeah, they were working on an imitation of the U.S. space shuttle.
Yeah, the Buran, which actually was somewhat different from the American space shuttle.
They were actually improving on it, but anyways.
No, there's no anyways about it. They did. It was, and there were two of them that were built, and I remember this much about it. I pronounced it Bhutan. Do I have it incorrect?
Buran.
Buran, okay. There were two of them that were built. The one that went up on a test flight into orbit was an unmanned, we'll call it a probe for the moment, just because. It landed on the runway that it was supposed to, if memory serves, 30 meters away from where it was supposed to finally end up because on the runway, just rolling and breaking. And it was within 30 meters of where it was supposed to have ended up. Totally, it was amazing. And unfortunately, the Russians did not finish funding it. And one of them, if I remember it, was simply taken apart. And one ended up in a hangar that subsequently collapsed from snow. And why did they do it? Because it was one-upmanship, and they actually had it. And unfortunately, it's another one of those things that go bye-bye.
All technological advances are one-upmanship, because we're always building the last technology, but it's just more useful if it's the same team developing.
So now what have we got? We've got one of the last pieces that we probably can springboard off of. This. The internet. An amazing, equalizing global network of information, the likes of which the librarians of Babylon could have only dreamed of. And it's just there. Always there. It's global. It's actually, you think about it, it's even extra global if you consider that the International Space Station has got access back and forth too.
You can get a live feed from the cameras on board the ISS.
And some of the movies that they've sent down have been absolutely gorgeous. Looking down at the Earth.
The sunrise 6 times a day. If I
were 16.
16 times a day, sorry.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you get to see the Earth in a way that we've never had the opportunity of, at least not in such a fashion. I mean, yeah, we had the pictures, the movie of Earthrise from the moon, and I've forgotten which Apollo mission that was from. It doesn't really much matter. But from the International Space Station, we've gotten movies where they're flying over the skies of the Southern Hemisphere, and they have movies of the Aurora Australis. And it's glorious. I've never seen the auroras personally myself, even though I'm far enough north that we could. I mean, Heretic Woman and I are not too very off from where we both are, latitude. And I've been lucky enough to see some shooting stars, but hon, have you ever been lucky enough to see the auroras up where you are?
No.
But we can see it whenever we want to, just by saying, hey, YouTube, let me, there it is. Well, that's good. Did I just go ahead and mute myself? No, I'm still there. Good.
Nope.
But the internet is a piece of the Cold War. It was so that it would have redundant communication in case any particular spot went away, so that in a nuclear war, we would still have communications all over the place. And it started off with a handful of colleges.
Actually, colliders, if I remember correctly. Research facilities.
Run out of a couple of college and universities, yes. I've forgotten off the top of my head which ones, but at this point it's kind of moot.
It was designed for the Cold War, now it's just used for the Flame War.
And trolling. And porn.
Yes, but that's a song that we won't play right now. If you don't know what I'm referring to, look up Avenue Q. And you can do that on whatever is the video storage system of choice now. And there in the future, in 3025. Hi, future!
Yeah.
We just got gay marriage here in the United States. All of North America's finally got it. Yay, us! We're not all dumb.
I won't laugh about it taking you an extra decade or nothing.
Something that always made me scratch my head about the International Space Station and satellites in general. For a long time, I didn't really think about it, but it always made me scratch my head. Why does it need engines if it's in orbit?
Oh,
but then...
Orbit changes.
Well, it's not just that. If there was nothing out there, they wouldn't need to. They would just stay in orbit. But, unfortunately, there is. Because, you know, the atmosphere, it's not just a line. Here's the atmosphere, here's space. There's still atmosphere all the way out there. It's just very thin. And that does gradually slow objects in orbit down. So for station keeping, which is, you know, staying in your orbital path, you do need engines to do so. And that's something that I had not thought about until relatively recently. So it's just a thing that made me, oh, well, that makes sense.
And that's something that is kind of sad, kind of cool all at the same time. The fact that the International Space Station does need to alter its trajectory every once in a while is because there's stuff up there. There's a lot of stuff up there that we've kind of left up there by accident. There are fairings left over from moonshots. There's
an amazing amount of garbage orbiting the Earth.
That's true. And somebody's putting out a lot of something. I don't know who's got the sound going on at the moment. Figure it from there.
Well, just a second. It's not me.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
There's a little background noise coming in every now and then.
Yeah, figure it out from there. Anyway, so we're getting down to the end of it all, and like
excuse me.
Yes.
Can I come back? You know, the thing you started with, this thing about Matt Slick. Can I go back to that, or is that way too off topic?
It wasn't what I was expecting, but feel free. And yeah, Heretic Woman, I did mute you out for a couple of moments. Yeah, whatever that background sound is, it's coming off of your mic. So we'll bring you back. You should be able to unmute yourself.
It's there you go. Probably the cat who's curled up around the microphone.
That'll do it.
All right, no worries. So yeah, go ahead, Joseph.
Yeah, well, your answer for him was right, but there's just one thing I want to say. If you want he wanted what? He wanted the proof for atheism that it's right.
Yes, his usual wording is, "What proof and evidence do you have that atheism is accurate and correct?" If memory serves, that should be the exact direct quote that he typically uses.
Yeah, well, that's just, disingenuous, too, because he's asking for proof of an absence of something, because, I mean, atheism is an absence of belief. But I can bring it down another level. I just say, well, I'm just not following your rules. That's all. And the proof is that, you know, I function very well without following your rules. And that's it.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy enough to prove atheism. I have an absence of belief in God. Done.
Yeah.
Yeah, on there. It's someone here who actually is positing some kind of supernatural entity that they have the burden of proving that.
Basically, what he's saying is that you are not capable of making decisions for yourself. You need us to decide everything for you. And that's their entire, that's the base of everything they're promoting. I mean, the rest is just detail.
I think what he's trying to conflate is atheism, which if you were to graphically show what atheism is on a graph, atheism would be at the origin point, a zero point. It has no place other than that one location right there. And anything other than that would be a belief either that there is or that there is not a god, any god, any gods.
I wouldn't even go there. I mean, their god inscription, all that, it's just a sales pitch prop. I mean, just, you know, to better sell their "we think for you" service. I mean, we're all born a blank slate, okay? And we've got one goal in life, and that's to adapt to our environment. And we do that through interaction with other people. And the service that he's promoting is, well, he wants to adapt for you, tell you how to adapt. So instead of deciding how to adapt yourself, he wants to do it for you. And that's the base of everything. I mean, the rest, you might as well just discard their God arguments and everything.
But my description, though, is that, like I was saying, if I look at it as atheism is at the origin point, it has no belief, positive or negative. You're at the starting point. And do you believe? It doesn't matter what the degree is. Once you've moved off of that zero point, whether it's yes, there is, or no, there can't be, then you've moved off of the center point. Doesn't matter what degree it is. How is atheism accurate and correct? I'm not convinced. There's nothing that's been shown to convince me. I'm right here. I'm still at the zero point. nobody's shown me anything to move me off of there. So, no, nothing. Like I said, that's pretty much where my point of it is, even though it's a... Oh, I'm going to get a whole bunch of hell for this one, but you know what? It's a shit question in the first place.
Can I start?
Go.
On that, for me, I start with the skeptical sort of point of view that you shouldn't accept any claim or worldview or theory, idea, whatever, on that unless you've got some reason to do so. On their
you have
some,
no other choice.
Yeah, I wouldn't say no other choice. Yeah, I mean, you can have a range of options in some things.
Or something that's an idea that doesn't affect anything physical.
Yeah, but unless you've got some evidence for a proposition, or at the very least, that it is logically and reasonably like self-consistent, and not contradicting other things that we know. There, you know, there's literally no reason to believe it, and so, if someone comes to you with the idea of a god of any type, and then the correct response, you know, is from the skeptical point of view, is to ask, you know, for reasons why you should believe this particular claim. And if they can't give you reasons, don't believe it. And I think that's a much more useful and intellectually honest approach than the alternative, which is just to believe, you know, any claim or any sort of selection of claims based on nothing, pretty much.
Because the goal is they want you to follow their rules. So if you're willing to accept their claims, then you're going to follow their rules. And that's it. That's what it comes down to. And it's not their claim is their claim. You're not believing their claim, you're believing them. And that's really the that's what affects us, because that's going to modify your behavior.
Yeah. I think
I've expressed that much better at other times when I've not been half asleep, so sorry if that wasn't very clear.
No, I got you.
I think what we should do is, at this point, we should just go ahead and table this, and when we get off the air, I will set up the next show before we hang up from each other, because we typically stay on and talk a little bit before. Since we will not have a show next weekend, because I'm going to be in Pittsburgh, Joey is, well, already there. There's a convention that's going on, and we're going to be taking part in Anthrocon. I will set up the show for 2 weeks from 2 weeks from tonight, and it will be named What's the Carm, so that we can kind of go through this, because I will admit I've been a little hard pressed for trying to come up with meatier, some might say angrier topics, and I think it's about time to finally start delving in a little bit more and start doing what we do best, which is ripping the crap out of stuff that really richly deserves it and the people that are behind it all.
I froze up for a bit there. Carm, what's that?
That's Matt Slick's website.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I've heard that before, yeah. Okay.
C-A-R-M. I forget what it stands for, though.
Crap.
Yeah.
Is what it comes down to. So,
Christian assholes.
I don't think that I can get away with having you say that.
Wait till we go off air to finish.
I mumbled.
Yeah, you know what? I'll do just like Jake Forwarden does. I'll just fix it in post-production. It'll be fine. I'll just cut it right out. Nobody will know.
Isn't that Dallin's job?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Dallin, yeah, go ahead and fix that for us, would you please? Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Any case, let's just go ahead and get our butts on out of here. And like I said, I will set everything up for 2 weeks from tonight. Those of you that are listening on the podcast, you know what? We'll get around to that in a second. And I'll kind of finish us off on a piece over here. You know what? Come to think of it, I did not have my usual closing comments of anything, so this is a little bit different. Maybe on top of everything else, maybe there's a specific viral plague that's coming from Amish Wolverine that I'm catching tonight, too. Yes, I managed to remember, because we missed a week. We missed a week, and so we'll go with that. Chris, what last thoughts would you like to finish out over here with?
If anyone out there is thinking of watching Ken Ham's new film, Audacity, don't. Just don't. The human brain is not meant to deal with such horrors.
Yeah, that sounds like more like an invitation than anything. Have a propensity for self-torture.
Or at least make sure like you've like not eaten anything like expensive before watching it, because you will be throwing up.
Or don't keep anything heavy around you. It's alright, you're going to throw it at you.
That sounds like something we should watch as a group on Hangouts, maybe.
Yeah, maybe strapped to a chair like Clockwork.
Holy crap, the Vlogcast do not condone any such torture to people, especially the use of saline on eyeballs, because I don't know, there's something in the Geneva Convention somewhere. Joey, there's something in the Geneva Convention about that, right? Sure, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure there is.
There's got to be. Of course there's got to be. Not to mention the fact that Scathing Atheist has already put out there on social media that it took him 3 hours to get through a 30-minute movie. Apparently he's watched it, and I still have to catch up to find out. I don't know. Find out about it. Anyway, Joseph, thank you, of course. What would you like to close out with everybody?
Me? Technology? Yeah. Just one thought, that technology was... You know, it's supposedly here to make our lives easier, make things cheaper, less labor involved, which means things should be less expensive. But instead, you know, people are using it to make a profit. And I'd kind of like to see that stop, that we have a little more understanding about our technology and actually what's going on behind the production scenes.
All right. Joey, I'm going to give you a chance on this one while I mute my microphone so I can grab a piece of technology for a closing comment.
All right. Well, we kind of started out with the whole turning rockets from military weapons into the vehicles which have taken us out among the stars, or at least, you know, into our galactic backyard. And there are a number of quotes that could be used to sum up how I feel about, you know, the way we have changed our how space travel has changed our perspective on the world. We have used these weapons of war among nations to go out to where there are no borders, there are no nations. And to close out, I'm just going to go ahead and quote Edgar Mitchell on this one. From out there on the moon, international politics looks so petty. You want to grab a politician by the scruff of the neck, drag him out 250,000 miles out and say, "Look at that, you son of a bitch."
That's actually really, really, really cool. I like that. And Heretic Woman, where would you like to close off for everybody with?
Well, a lot of the stuff, as you say, was used and developed for military purposes and for killing, possibly, or to facilitate better killing, but we've taken almost all of that now and used it for much more useful purposes, benign purposes, and I think that's you know, we have a tendency to go, oh, that was used for bad things and it must always be bad. And I think we need to stop doing that. And just because something may not have had the best of origins does not make it what it is. So, because there's things out there, I think, that if people knew where they came from, they might think twice about wanting to use that technology, but I think that's kind of silly. And when you think of things in that context, you give power to the negativity, I think. So.
Fair enough. So, really quickly, I'm not going to exactly get up on a high horse or nothing, but I just want to put something into stark reality for folks. This is paper. Yeah, I know it's kind of anticlimactic, yeah, but there's a very long, rich history that goes into this very simple throwaway item now, and it's a great storehouse for information. I mean, hell, we've got untold numbers of plays, writings that are on these things in various formats. The library that was covered over in Italy because of a volcanic eruption, they've tried to look at the stuff, and as soon as you touch it, it falls apart because it's ash. And now with new technologies, they're finding ways of reading the ink on the pages without turning the pages. How cool is this? Now, like I said, paper is a nothing now. And it houses information like crazy. And then you've got these. CDs hold who only knows how many pages of information that a piece of paper could hold. I mean, you cramp up your arm before you expend however much information you can have on one of these. And these are pretty common, throwaway almost these days. So, granted, you should really recycle these more, but whatever.
Or coasters.
You know, put it. You find one that says you've got mail on it, and you can make a nice light show for yourself. Because I mean, you know, fireworks at home. And then you've got this. Some of you actually recognize what this is.
I've used them.
This is a 100 megabyte zip disk. Yes, you heard me right. 100 megabyte zip disk. Believe it or not, when these came out from iOmega, I was fortunate enough to get one of the early versions of the SCSI. Yes, you heard me right. SCSI, S-C-S-I. Look it up sometime. Version of the external zip drive. And it was perfect because my very first computer had a 100 megabyte, yes, you heard me right, megabyte hard drive. And I utilized one of these as my backup for my main hard drive. Whenever I wanted to back it up, I just popped this in, copied everything over, done. This is effectively no more. Nobody uses these because they're useless, quite literally by the term itself.
Because I've got optical discs I can't even read.
Yeah, and because now you've got one of these. This that I hold now is an 8 gigabyte. Yes, you heard me right, gigabyte thumb drive. I got this for about, I don't know, $20.
Where'd you find one that small?
I've had this for a little while. As a matter of fact, I've got one in my car that one of the first ones that I got a jump drive, and it was 64 megabytes, and it was so old that it originally came with a driver disk for Windows. Yeah, you needed a specific driver for it because it was relatively new at the time, and Windows didn't have the driver for it.
See, I want to find some 500 megabyte ones because I like those for mixtapes.
64 gigabytes.
No. I want a 500 meg flash drives.
Yeah. But here's the thing. The technology, no matter what its origin, is always continuing to evolve. It gets better. It gets smaller. It gets more... it gets more affordable or less expensive, depending as to how you look at it. And it becomes more accessible. I mean, you think about it, an 8 gigabyte hard drive was unthinkable.
Yeah, they've actually got terabyte ones out now.
Exactly.
Shopping results, $888, so waiting for the price to come down on that.
Yeah.
But in 6 months, they'll be probably going for peanuts.
Yeah. And I've seen on store shelves 6 terabyte hard drives for computers. But just
I've got a 4 terabyte right now.
But just for carting information around just because you can, 8 gigabytes of data. Just because. And it's, at this point, it's a throwaway piece that companies will put a whole bunch of information on and take them to a trade show and, oh, here's some of our information. It's a good drive. It's 8 gigs. You know, you can put a whole bunch of stuff on there anyway. Oh, okay, I'll just add it to my keyring with a whole bunch of others and just put it in your pocket and you're done. You don't even think about it. The point is, no matter the origin of this stuff, it's going to continue to evolve. And in some cases, it's going to evolve in ways that we can't even begin to imagine at this point. Sure, we've got these great outlandish ideas for storage mediums, holographic storage on a crystal, which is all well and good, but you know, who's really doing that? Who's really investigating that? We don't even know. Maybe there's something that's going to be based off of quantum fluctuations. Who knows? Maybe there's something that we have no idea about at this point. Maybe somebody's got a way of looking up information in a method that we just don't even have technology for yet today. It wouldn't surprise me. But so many more of these are now coming from benign sources, fun sources, imaginative sources. Mm. And I like that. I like that a lot. We don't have to be pushed for dominance to jump over somebody else technologically. Sometimes we can just push ahead because it's fun. I think that's so cool. As always, everyone, thank you so very much for being with us tonight. We hope that you've enjoyed yourself and found something worthwhile. We know that we are not the best vlogcast out there. We sure as hell ain't the worst. That's for damn sure. But no matter what, all of our perspectives we think are worthwhile, and thank you for taking the time to listen to some of them. As always, everybody on the panel, thank you very much for your time. Chris, have yourself a good morning, and thanks for showing up late, but you showed up. That's okay. Next time, bring enough gum for the rest of the class, would you please? you can say good morning and goodbye.
Oh, goodbye.
Wow, it really is. Goddamn.
Sorry, the 5 o'clock starts really hit me this morning for some reason.
That's all right. Go on back to bed. Have yourself a great one. Joseph, thank you so much. Have a good morning. Did you want to plug anything at this point?
Oh, nothing to plug. Just, yeah, well, thanks for having me on, and yeah, it was fun. And see you next time.
Yep, 2 weeks. Joey, I'll see you soon, man. I'm working on that, the bear claw ring. I don't know if I'm going to have that, but if nothing else, I will have a bunch of bear claws regardless.
I'll have some beer for you.
I don't like beer. Good morning. Take care of yourself.
You're dead to me.
I have wine, and you know it.
Yeah, wine. You can keep your grape juice.
More for me in, oh shoot, who's going to have...
Californian wine.
No. It's from the college out over here in Western New York.
I want to go to Hollywood.
Oh, right, that.
Yes, my wine. You know about my wine.
Okay.
My wine is dangerous. And the Heretic Woman, of course, good morning. You take care of yourself, hon. Anybody who has not yet seen all the pictures of when she was down there motorbiking out here in US of A, those are great pictures, man.
I haven't even gotten through a fraction of them yet. I'm hoping after the show on Monday night, I'll have some time to sit down and sift through them and post some more.
Good luck.
Please do.
I shall, because it was really, really gorgeous.
Plug all the things, hon.
Okay, well, of course, there is...
That's enough of that. Thank you so much for being honest.
Yeah. Don't make me throw this cat at you.
I'm not saying it's not a power of
attorney. Beyond the Trailer Park, of course, Monday nights at 9:30 Eastern on my YouTube channel, Beyond the Trailer Park. This week we are having Eric Thomas, who is the president of Humanist Canada, who's going to join us for the evening. And you guys may not have heard yet, because I know how hard it is to listen to everyone else's show, but Miss Ashley is now an official co-host of the show. Hmm. So we had that announcement. Well, she was supposed to get announced the week before that, which was the day after I left her. And apparently once I skipped town, a giant storm rolled in and killed all of their power for the evening. So she was not able to come on the show that night. But so she's official co-host, and looking forward to that. So that's this Monday. Of course, there's My Secular Savior, mysecularsavior.com. And now I can tell you guys a little bit about show number 3, which is called Atheist Apocalypse, the podcast. We're looking to launch episode 1 next month. It is in production now. It's looking pretty good. And it's an ensemble cast of several folks that you will probably recognize several of them when you hear it. But please visit our Facebook page, Atheist Apocalypse, the podcast. And we are throwing out some teasers and some interesting memes. So drop by and you'll find out more information when we get closer to our launch date.
Taking a little nod from my use of the X-cast there, hey? Just maybe a little bit?
That wasn't my doing. That was Mr. Paul, who's was the brains behind the operation. So, we shall see.
I had a little bit of influence on that, so yeah. I'm just going to take that in the wind column.
And there's at least one mustachioed person in the cast, although his characters may or may not have mustaches, I don't know. But, definitely some funny accented folks will be forthcoming.
Anybody that we know?
Could very well be.
I think she just told you. Jesus.
Fair enough. All right, so Nick, it's going to be great to see you on that show. You have yourself a great time on that.
Here. This is not going to be video. This is audio only. So an actual podcast.
Fair enough.
There you go. And I think that's everything. Yeah.
Fair enough.
I think that's it. Yep.
So, folks, we will be seeing you in 2 weeks from now, unless, of course, you're on the audio feed, in which case you can load us up now and see what happens with that. The next scheduled show is going to be the 19th of July, and like I said, before we get done with our thing, we're going to go ahead and make sure that the information is out there ahead of time to get everybody an opportunity to throw up a little bit in their mouths, trying to cram down what the hell CARM is all about. And just, I will say up front, I'm sorry. Okay, I know it's going to be painful. I know it's going to hurt some people's brains, but I'm sorry. Just got to be done. And if we end up having troll posts from the CARM group, we will have won. Don't go baiting them, but if they come all on their own, we will have won.
Come and, yeah, I hope they do.
Oh, I hope
I do
so.
Too. I do too. There's a Chad fellow who I would love to say hello to again.
I'm sorry, did you say Chad or Chode? I'm trying to figure out what you're talking about at the moment.
I think it's interchangeable.
I'm sorry, did I say that out loud? I'm sorry. Are we good?
Yeah, we're still on the air, dude.
Oh, yeah, that's right. <Thank you. laughs> We'll see all of you guys very soon, and of course, thank you. Thank you for letting us be a piece of your time, and thank you for giving us part of your time. We know for Will, there's a lot of stuff you could have been doing. Thank you for spending part of your time with us. Dallin, this is where the exit music goes, because he's the audio bitch, he's not here. So everybody, until the very next time we get together, I wish you the peace I no longer have. I wish you the strength that I've learned. I wish you well. And of course, say goodnight for all of you, and I say goodnight for my lady too. Because a decade on, I'm still in love. Matane Fujin, I love you and I miss you. Dream on. And until the next time we get together, everyone, take good care of yourselves, and see you later. Good night.
You've been listening to Holy Crap, the Vlogcast. Feel free to leave a comment on the show's website at holycrapthevlogcast.com, where you'll also find links to our Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Google Plus pages. Theme music provided by Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com. On behalf of all of us here, thank you for listening.